Chapter 10, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 10, Getting Outside the Insides of Greece. We returned to Patras from Kalavryta, and I slept fitfully, haunted by the faces of the women and children in black. But the next morning was so ecstatically bright on the Gulf of Patras right outside my hotel window that I cheered up considerably. I'm like that. I forget easily, much too easily. The whole blue-green harbor was within spitting distance of my balcony. White gulls circled above, and innumerable fishing boats lined the wharves. Two were long and curved like the new moon, and were ragged robin blue. Slightly aloof from the little boats, a United States Liberty ship with a gaudy yellow smokestack circled in white and black was unloading flour. While I was still hanging off the balcony and far from dressed, Eleni popped in. "My God," she cried, "what a fright." I cringed. I knew I wasn't at my best early in the morning, but I didn't think I was that bad. Happily, with her next words, I discovered it was not the fright to which she referred. When Costa came this morning for money, I asked him how is the Jeep. I always ask him how is the Jeep. It is the first love. He says it is not all right. He says it has a big hole in the benzene tank. My God, this was poison in my mind. My breath was finished. It was poison in my mind, too, for how could we travel without the Jeep? But everything turned out entaxia, which is the Greek word for all right. Costa bought a half-pound Turkish Delight, that clear, sticky candy that is like our gum drops, except it is square and heavily coated with powdered sugar, and stuck it in the hole. With the help of God, we can travel the whole of Greece with this, Eleni declared optimistically. After eating a breakfast of sourish brown bread, butter, and honey, and drinking many tiny cups of Turkish coffee, we strolled out onto the pier to see the sights of the harbor better. Many of the fishing boats, which the Greek call kaikis, were unloading crocus sacks of currants from other sections of the Peloponnesus. The stone pavement of the pier was black with the tiny sticky fruit that spilled from holes in the bags. "The riches of the Peloponnesus are the currants," Eleni said. "We used to ship them before the war everywhere, but mainly to England to use in their cookies and cakes for afternoon tea." The harbor of Patras had been mined, of course, during the war, and all shipping stopped. Even the kaikis were not destroyed by the Germans could not venture out to fish. Patras was bombed on October 28, 1940 by the Italians, before the Greeks even knew the Italians had declared war. Many of the women were in the streets on the way to school for their children, and several were killed, and a large number of houses and public buildings were badly damaged. Leaving the harbor and walking about the town, I saw a street being repaired. Three buildings, shoulder to shoulder, had been rebuilt and painted pale green, soft pink, and warm cream. On the street floor, one of them was a movie theater, and it was showing National Velvet with Mickey Rooney. Coming soon was Meet Me in St. Louis. We piled into the Jeep to journey to Agrinion on the mainland. Our consciences hurt us a little, for we had not spoken to Mr. Gordon again about the trip to Delphi as he had asked us to do. But we were still determined to go, and we didn't want him to feel he must go with us. If there was to be spilled blood, let it rest on our own stubborn heads. To reach the mainland, we first had to drive to a point of land a mile or two from the fishing village of Rion and catch a ferry. This point juts out into the gulf from the Peloponnesus and almost meets another point jutting out from the mainland near the village of Antirion. Tremendous weather-beaten Venetian castles sit on both points on the water's edge. They date back to about the Middle Ages, says Eleni carelessly. We buy tickets for the ferry and have cups of coffee at a tiny wooden shack a goodly distance back from the beach. It is now 10:30. The ferry will run, the ticket agent informs us, when there are enough passengers. It sounds discouraging. Traffic is so scarce on the terrible Greek highways, it might take all day to get enough passengers. I really don't care. It is peaceful and lovely by the sea, and the sun presses down warm and caressing. I take off my unhappy black coat and unhappy black hat and stretch out on the sand. At 11:30, things begin to happen. Trucks arrive from Patras with 60 mules. I am positive they are either Tennessee or Missouri mules, for they are the only two states I know of that have mules. They must have come over on the Liberty ship we saw unloading in Patras. They look thin and shaggy and have numbers branded on their rumps. The ferry comes over from Antirion. It is not a real ferry, but a landing barge evidently left over from the war. We saunter down to the water's edge to watch the passengers come off. One is a fair-haired, blue-eyed English soldier. On the pocket of his khaki blouse is the insignia of the English military mission, a badge in blue and white with a gold crown in the center. We chat. He has come across from the mainland to go to Athens via Patras and Corinth. I tell him we are headed for the mainland to go to Athens via Delphi. He looks shocked. "Come with us," I ask him casually. "No, thank you," he answers. "I don't care to have leave my bones in Greece." He strides off. "My God, what have you done now?" cries Eleni. "You invite an English soldier to go with us into the guerrilla country. When I hear you, I had the chills all over. God, how the guerrillas hate the British. When they see a British with us, we are finished. Sure, we will be killed, 100%. I try to calm her. No harm has been done. The Englishman has refused the invitation. She knows, but her heart will never beat the same again. Three or four Greek mule drivers and I try to shoo the mules onto the ferry. I, having had lots of practice and prospect carrying billy goats, mules, and horses, figure I can be of real service here on the sands of Rion. We run circles around the mules. We wave our arms. We yell. As Eleni would say, "My God, how we yell." But the mules do not care for the barge. They prefer the sand or even the sea. Several times we have them almost to the ramp when they turn and tear down the beach toward Patras. "Oh, oh, oh," the Greek drivers bawl, though I had no idea they knew English. "Oh, oh, oh." Finally, the last mule clatters across the iron ramp. The Greeks double over with laughter. They beat each other on the backs. They stomp their feet. "Oh, oh, oh." With the mules loaded, Costa, with the jeep and the other passengers and I, go aboard. Alina, Margaret, and I climb to the upper deck to sit in the sun. "Much more fresher up here," Eleni remarks. We are ready to leave. The whistle blows. The gangplank is hauled up. But hold everything. A fat woman with two brimming baskets wobbles across the deep sand. The gangplank is lowered. A deckhand runs to meet her and takes the baskets. "Make your cross," Eleni advises, "that no one else arrives." Fortunately, no one does, and we cast off at 11:50, just an hour and 20 minutes after schedule. It is nothing in Greece. I gaze back at the Peloponnesus. From the shore, an Irish green slope climbs slowly up a long, low range of mountains. The slope is pierced together like a homemade rug with light and dark green strips. Behind the range is another, a black green. And behind that, soaring into the sky, a series of snow-streaked peaks. Turning toward the mainland, I'm amazed at the change in the landscape. "A very different nature," says Eleni. "The mountains are bare and misty gray, and they stand spaced one from another." A company of Greek soldiers lines the shore at Antirion. They have come to escort me, the American visitor, to Agrinion, the captain of the landing barge announces. Naturally, I am overwhelmed. I have scarcely ever been escorted by one male, much less a company. I have no idea how to fall in with an escort or even how to fall out with one. Eleni, Margaret, and I run up and down the sand trying to decide what to do. How can a jeep be escorted by a company of soldiers on foot? That's what we'd like to know. Alini takes matters in hand. She walks over to interview the captain of the company. In a few moments, she returns grinning. The soldiers are not for us, after all. They have come to meet a general who is expected on our ferry. The ferry captain had simply had a brainstorm. Costa had told him I was from the United States, so when he saw the soldiers, he thought, ah, they are for her. Delighted at our deliverance, we bump towards Agrinion. The road is full of holes and is as full of holes as a muffin pan. It is impossible to avoid them. The jeep falls in, jumps out. How is it? How is your downstairs? Asks Galini. My what? Your downstairs. What you call it? What you sit on? My downstairs is all right. How about a hard-boiled egg? She asks. She opens the lunchbox packed with eggs, sandwiches, and oranges and gets out four eggs. See how hard a Greek head is? She says and smashes the first egg on her forehead. I show you again, she says, and smashes another one. We bounce about in the jeep eating eggs. You must always have food on a jeep trip, Alini argues. During the time when I traveled all day, week after week, in a jeep, I always carried a vegetable soup mixture that only needed to have water added to it. It came from America, and we baptized it Roosevelt Soup. It was very good. We begin to climb a long mountain on the edge of the sea. The mountain is bare except for small shrubs and blankets of white daisies called margaritas. Alini and Margaret burst into a Greek song about margaritas. They are delighted with it and with themselves and sing it again and again. Almost at the top of the mountain, Costa stops the jeep. He must look at the Turkish delight to see if it is still holding. Margaret and Eleni and I jump out behind him. Only a sheer rocky drop of many hundreds of feet is between us and the sea. The water is no longer green, but a purple as clear and deep as an amethyst, and the air is steeped in pale gold sunshine. I suddenly want to fly like the gulls. I feel light-hearted and light-footed. Costa adds three more Turkish delights to the hole in the tank. Intoxie, he says, and we climb back in. Alini and Margaret have picked handfuls of margaritas. Like 16-year-olds, they pluck the petals, murmuring, he loves me not. But, after all, it is spring. We stop in Missolonghi, where Lord Byron died in 1824 while fighting for Greek freedom. But instead of looking for his tomb, we find a restaurant, and at Eleni's command, follow her into the kitchen to see what is cooking. This was my introduction to studying firsthand the food simmering in the enormous copper pots on the big black wood stoves of Greek restaurants, but not my last. Alini never ate anything that I can remember without going upon arrival into the kitchen, peering closely into the pots, sniffing, stirring spoons around in the concoctions and asking questions, and I must say all the Greek cooks accepted it as a matter of course. This day in historic Missolonghi, we have inkfish with macaroni, which does not look as appetizing as it tastes, for the inkfish makes the macaroni black and greasy, and with it a fine green salad of marulia seasoned with tiny fresh onions and olive oil dressing, and for dessert, feta, a salty white cheese from goat's milk. In the middle of the afternoon, we arrive in Agrinion, and after registering in a spotlessly clean hotel, we go to the Near East Foundation's Eagle's Nest. Here 200 children between the ages of 6 and 14 are brought in from the surrounding burned villages and kept for 3 months at a time. They are chosen from families in the worst condition and with the most children. 25% of them are orphans. They arrive undernourished and anemic, without shoes and in rags. First they are bathed and have physical examinations. Then they are given haircuts, new clothes, and shoes, and the girls get pink and blue hair ribbons. The change in their appearance is so marked that frequently brothers and sisters do not recognize each other. The task of teaching the children the correct rules of health then begins. They are taught how to bathe, to clean their teeth, to eat the proper foods, to keep their clothes, and to make their beds. Many of them have been living in caves and dugouts for years and have never even seen beds. Then, of course, their bodies are built up. They are fed cod liver oil, milk, fresh fruit, cereal, vegetables, meat, and other good substantial foods. The pantry makes my mouth water. It is jammed with barrels of ripe olives because of their high nutritive value. And in Greece, their low cost, with cheese, peanut butter, cans of pet milk, salmon, and soups. A doctor comes daily and checks on the condition of the children. We meet him the afternoon of our visit, and Alini introduces him to Margaret and me simply as our doctor. He is fairly young, with somber dark eyes and thick curly black hair. He has one of the kindest expressions I have ever seen on a human face, and one of the saddest, too. After 3 months, the children return to their village, and a new batch comes in. They go back to their mothers, if they have mothers, Alini explains, or to their grandmothers or aunts or friends in the villages. They do not have the excellent life, but what can we do? She looks at me intently, waiting for an answer. I have none, she goes on. Some come as animals, and some go back to animals. Others take the good things back. They bring civilization to villages. Some of them even insist on beds. When we start for our hotel, the children are standing in a square formation on the playground. It is sunset, and they are getting ready to lower the blue and white Greek flag that is rippling lazily on its tall staff. Loudly and excitedly, they sing the Greek national anthem. The flag flutters down. Two small boys catch it, fold it, and lay it on the outstretched arms of a third. They then march solemnly about the square as the other children stand at attention. The flag ceremony is over. They form into a circle and begin to sing and dance. It is the native dance of Crete, Alina tells me. It has a queer offbeat rhythm, and the tune is in a minor key and plaintive. The boys then dance along, dragging their feet and moving their legs in a queer, slow, slinky motion, and as they dance, they sing. This tune, too, is sad, haunting, with what I think of as a Turkish flavor. It's the girls' turn. They dance the karaguna. The boys squat in the middle and sing with the girls as they dance. I can stand on the sidelines no longer. Being an old square dancer from Kentucky, I must get into this. Immediately I'm lost. There is a quick half step I cannot manage. The boys and girls roar with laughter. There is also a backward step I cannot get. They roar some more. I'm evidently the funniest thing they have ever seen on a playground floor. Finally, exhausted, I fall out, and our doctor thinks I need a little wine for my heart palpitation. He invites us to a taverna to have retzina. But before we can go, we must drop by our hotel and freshen up. As we enter, the clerk hands Alini a wrinkled slip of dingy white paper with some writing scrawled over it in pencil. My God, she cries, excitedly, a cablegram. From the United States? I ask just as excitedly, thinking of all cablegrams have to come from across the Atlantic Ocean. No, my dear, from Athens. Alas, it is a telegram from Laird Archer. We read it with sinking hearts. Embassy states not wise to return via Delphi, which agree. Stop. Telephone before leaving Agrinion. Archer. So that's it. We stand on the marble steps of the hotel in the little, narrow, dusty street and talk over what to do. A few feet away sits a Greek truck loaded with Greek soldiers, their long guns slung on straps over their shoulders. Several of them look familiar. They had been among the group that had been at the Antirion to meet the general. Evidently, the general is here, too. Is Agrinion expecting aid from the guerrillas? I look about somewhat apprehensively, but the town seems unalarmed. In the bare, sand-packed square, dozens of men are walking as usual in twos and threes and fours, up and down, up and down. One man passes close by carrying unwrapped a large dried codfish. An old woman plods along, her back bent double under a load of branches that sweep from curb to curb. "We will go to see the chief of police," Alini announces, "and see what he has to say. Then we will call Mr. Archer." The chief of police occupies a large upstairs room with a handsome picture of the king, loaded with ribbons and medals, as the only decoration in the cracked plastered walls. The chief is tall and broad-shouldered, as a Greek chief should be, and his thick black curly hair flares out from his head as if he were standing in a high wind. He receives us cordially, shaking our hands vigorously and asking me how I am enjoying Greece. In a great rush of Greek, Alini explains our problem, and then, in an even greater rush of Greek, he answers her. "Officially, the chief advises us not to go," Alini interprets. "But unofficially, he does not believe there's any real danger of our being shot. We will be stopped, yes, we will be questioned, and no doubt we will be searched, but he does not believe that we will be shot." The incident to which Mr. Gordon referred involved a Greek major and his men who were taking supplies to a government outpost. Naturally, the guerrillas captured him and his men and stole the supplies. The chief shrugs his big shoulders. Then, staring straight at my gray hair and sagging jowls, he says, "Of course the guerrillas take what they want, but I think, Mrs. Etheridge, you will be safe." I've never been so insulted in my life, but aside from this personal humiliation, the interview is most satisfactory. We can now phone Laird Archer and tell him the chief of police of Agrinion thinks it is safe for us to go ahead. But there are more complications. The telephone line is down between Agrinion and Patras, so there's no telephone connection between Agrinion and Athens. "Surely it will be fixed in an hour or two," I say. "My God, who knows," Elena shouts. "Maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow, maybe next week." We are in a quandary. We feel we cannot go ahead without talking to Laird Archer, and yet there is no way to reach him. We cannot even send him a cable, it seems. We are only 300 miles from Athens, but we are as far away as the moon. Oh well, we'll go now and join the doctor in the taverna. The narrow streets are thronged with people walking leisurely in the semi-darkness. I feel as if I'm back in Kentucky at the Kentucky State Fair, pushing along the midway. There is the same aimless appearing throng, the same dust, the same flickering carbon lights, the same booths along the sidewalks displaying a conglomeration of cheap goods. There are stacks of bright tin trunks, painted orange and yellow, rolls of pink mattresses, shoes hanging like dried peppers on strings beside doors. Windows heaped with vases, water glasses, dishes, figurines, beads, pitchers and pots and pans, bins of tiny onions, dried peas, lentils, potatoes, white beans, dried figs, oranges, lemons, and hard candies, barrels of wrinkled ripe olives, stacks of wide, loose hearth brooms, and clotheslines full of men's pants. My eyes are wide with wonder as we saunter along. Here it is between 8 and 9 o'clock, and all these tiny stores are open, and all the male population and a good sprinkling of the female are parading up and down as if there were nothing else in the world to do. "Would you like kokoretsi?" Eleni asked me. "Ah, kokoretsi," sighs Margaret, her eyes cast heavenward. "Come," says Eleni. We go into a tiny hole in the wall and see small pieces of meat strung on skewers, sputtering over three glowing chunks of charcoal. "There is kokoretsi, there on this end," said Eleni. "Kokoretsi is little pieces of liver, heart, and kidneys wrapped tightly in lamb guts." She licks her lips. "Nice, is it not?" "Very nice, I'm sure," I answer in a weak voice. "Good. By coincidence, you will have one." She turns to the man presiding over the charcoal burner. At that moment, he is twisting a huge entrail of some unfortunate beast onto a fresh skewer. Nice, is it not? I say to Margaret. Ah, she sighs. It is delicious. Again, the cook grabs an entrail or an intestine or some other intimate organ. I only know it is long and white and shiny, and strings it onto another skewer. Come, says Eleni. We have preserved the kokoretsi, and while it is cooking, we will go to the taverna and have retzina. The kokoretsi must cook very slowly on a very few charcoals to be good. We stroll down the street to the taverna, and to my horror, sit at a table in the middle of the road. In fact, it is in the middle of the junction of two roads. Won't someone something run over us here, I demand? Eleni shouts with laughter. No, my dearest, she says, but at that very moment a horse drawing a high-wheel cart trots directly toward us. He has gay ribbons and bells twinkling around his neck, but even so I don't care to have him trample me over. I clutch the table with the idea of getting under it. Whoa, I cry, whoa! Thank the Lord, he understands English. His hot breath blowing down my neck, he turns just in the nick of time and misses me. Still, I am nervous. A truck with one light points straight at us. This time we will surely be killed. Again, I clutch the table, and again I am saved by a will's breath. The waiter brings one plate heaped with small, crisp chunks of tripe, liver, entrails, and other organs. He puts it in the middle of the table and gives each of us a fork. I dip into the plate and choose a likely-looking tidbit. It tastes wonderful. Intoxie? Elena and our doctor ask anxiously. Intoxie. They beam with pleasure. Soon the plate is empty and the waiter brings another with new organs. Ah, the kokoretsi, Eleni claims. It is true. The chef of the kokoretsi grill has come through the street to the taverna, bringing our order. The intimate bits look like the other intimate bits that we have been eating, but Eleni and Margaret assure me they taste different. I eat at random. Why be choosy about guts, I reason. Guts are guts, and lights are lights, and if I'm going to turn into an intestine eater, I might as well go the whole hog. Except, of course, these organs are lamb. Again the plate is empty. It is amazing. I wait impatiently for the next serving. This time it is different again. It is a combination of liver and spleen. I sort of balk at the spleen. For some reason I had thought spleen was a liquid and bitter like gall. But no, this spleen is very much like liver except tenderer and juicier. Our doctor pokes around in the plate and finds me a rare piece. I shut my eyes and bite down upon it. It melts in my mouth. No broiled chicken liver at a swish cocktail party ever tasted better. After that, I settle down to steady spleen eating. The moon is a pale faraway yellow, moves slowly up the sky, and a gramophone across the square plays. Green eyes with purple lashes taught me to love. Only a few men walk in the square now, and no women. Suddenly, the shouts of a newsboy fill the square and the streets. He cries wildly and loudly, as if he is selling extras. Men run out of the taverna and from the square, calling for copies. Alina shouts out, too, and waves a piece of money. What is it? I ask anxiously. Tell me quickly. I have no thought other than that war has started again at full tilt. It is nothing, said Eleni, except that the papers arrived from Athens. But why all the excitement? It is always so, she grins. You must, how you say it, get accustomed to it. Everybody in Greece reads papers and talks politics. My God, how it is so! She wrinkles her nose. But this paper does have news of shocking import. By the pale, steady glow of the moon and the flickering beams of a small street light, Eleni reads that the Greek government has rounded up and arrested that day 571 communists in Athens who were supplying arms and food to the guerrillas in the mountains. She is pleased. It is time, she said. We cannot bear longer Greek fighting Greek. My God, it is terrible. It is worse than German occupation. A chill wind blows down from the surrounding mountains. My feet are cold as ice. Let us go to bed, I say, so we can get an early start in the morning. End of chapter 10.